Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant personal finance editor Helen Crane. And coming up, from Bitcoin to GameStop, is lockdown stress causing us to make harmful investing decisions? Searching for a new property online, we tell you the simple tech tricks to ensure you don't scroll past your dream home. Meanwhile, with rates on 2 and 5 year fixed mortgages now just a fraction apart, should you lock in to a long-term deal? Grace is back on the case this week. VW are in the dock. And should you ever fly again, we look at the best ways to earn miles from your everyday spending. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, how has a struggling US computer game retailer hit hard by coronavirus and lockdowns, which actually announced plans to close a large number of stores last year, become the world's hottest stock? The story has got investors, the financial press, and Elon Musk all of a tizzy. Simon, explain to us GameStop. What is this all about? Who are they? Why are we talking about them?
So I think probably before we start on what the real story is with GameStop, we probably need to fill in on some of the backstory. But just to give a brief bit of the real story for any listeners who haven't been paying attention, as the news bandwagon rolled on at an even more frenetic pace than usual this week, literally blink and you missed it, GameStop is a US computer games company whose shares have been sent to stratospheric heights by a buying spree triggered by small-time traders on the Reddit Wall Street Bets thread, which then spread out of the Reddit Wall Street Bets thread into social media, back into the Reddit Wall Street Bets thread, which saw huge numbers of people flocking in. People have been rushing to buy in what is arguably an orchestrated fashion, because they're all doing it at the same time, and they're all doing it for, well, two reasons. The shares of this company, and in fact, in many cases, they're not even buying the shares of this company. They're buying something called call options, which we talked about as a high-risk trading strategy that there were concerns about on the podcast last week. Little did we know quite how that one was going to unfold in about 3 days' time. It has sent the shares up by an enormous amount. It's put a short squeeze onto hedge funds who have been shorting the shares, which then increases the pressure on the shares to go up because the hedge funds have to go buy the shares. It's spilled straight out of Reddit and social media and into the headlines and onto financial regulators' plates. And there's all kinds of accusations flying around, questions of whether this is greed, whether this is actually people fighting back against Wall Street, and so on. But to go back to that backstory, GameStop is a struggling, long-standing US video game retailer. I think it's been around for about 37 years, is my understanding. It, like many other bricks and mortar retailers, has been hit very hard by coronavirus and lockdowns, and announced plans to close a large number of stores last year. Its share price, obviously, under the circumstances, had sunk. It's one of those companies that it is not considered a lockdown winner. It was a lockdown loser. Back in autumn, a guy called Ryan Cohen stepped in and took a stake in GameStop. Ryan Cohen is a man who founded a multi-billion dollar internet pet supply store, Chewy, which managed to, in a way, successfully take on Amazon at its own game. It took a market, pet food, pet supplies, and digitized it and fought back against the giant internet retailers. It did very well. Ryan Cohen sold out for you know, in the billions, and it's now a tens of billions company. So when he got involved in GameStop, with the intention of reviving it, it garnered quite a bit of attention. He was going to position it to take on Goliath. But as is the case, not everyone was backing that story. There were people who had their doubts. They said, well, look, he just because he did it with pet food, pet supplies, doesn't mean he can do it with video games. Video games are a totally different arena. And also a lot of the video game market is shifting to internet downloads anyway. And a lot of that's just going to be direct from video game makers. He's not going to do it. So some of the hedge funds and some of the other big investors decided to short the shares. When you short a company's shares, what it means is that you profit if they fall. So in most cases, people buy shares, they go long. And that means if the share price goes up, they benefit. If you go short, you benefit if the share price goes down. And effectively what you're doing is borrowing the shares from someone, then you return those shares when you can buy them back at a lower price. So an analogy, you know, that was put out yesterday was, imagine going and buy a comedian, Tessa Coates, was you go to the shop and you see a coat for $10 and you think, okay, I'm gonna get that coat. But instead you borrow a coat off somebody else on the expectation that the price of coats is going to go down and that you can buy the coat for $5 and return that coat to that person. And it'll only cost you $5 to get the coat. But then all of a sudden, everybody tries to buy coats and the price of coats goes up massively. And a coat costs $100 and you're in trouble because you owe somebody a coat. That's a very simplistic explanation of short selling, but it's not a bad one, to be honest. But hedge funds, they have a tendency, they can't just short shares quietly, some of these guys. They have to make a big song and dance about it. And they have to write these long investor notes and theses explaining how clever they are and all the research they've done and why the price is going to go down. Now, some of that is a thinly disguised attempt to push the price down. And some of them is just them showing off. We know how clever rich people like to show off, don't we? So far, value investing. You've got the people buying the beaten down company. You've got the hedge funds going short on it. And then some weird stuff started to happen. Earlier this month, just over a fortnight ago, it was announced that Ryan Cohen would be joining the GameStop board. That's the kind of good news that boosts the share price. And it climbed. It went up 50% within a couple of days. And it almost doubled in less than 10 days. But then it just started to go up and up and up and up. So from $39 on the 20th of January, by Monday, the 25th of January, the shares were at $76. By Tuesday, they were at $148. And on Wednesday afternoon, they were at $332. What was happening was there was this orchestrated buying of the shares by people in the, led on by this kind of chat room thing, going, buy them, buy them, buy them, we'll squeeze them, we'll squeeze them, we'll squeeze them, we'll fight back. The narrative has become one of anger against the system. It was described as rage against the financial machine. It's sticking one in the eye to Wall Street. A couple of the hedge funds that were shorting the shares have had to fold their positions. One of them has made a colossal loss, and another hedge fund has come in and picked up a stake in it on the cheap. A lot of this has been done through the trading app Robinhood. GameStop shares, by the time Robinhood ceased buying of them yesterday, had risen almost 1,600% in 16 days. Then all of a sudden, Robinhood says you can't buy any more shares. People get angry. They allege conspiracy. They say that there's another big financial institution, Citadel, claiming that it owns Robinhood and it stopped people buying the shares through Robinhood because Citadel also has a stake in Melvin, which is shorting the stock. There's only like about one thing in that is true. Citadel does not own Robinhood. Robinhood is privately owned. Citadel pays Robinhood for order flow, which is what pays for customers of Robinhood to have free trading. But it gives Citadel information on what's being traded so it can then get ahead of the trades and try to make money. Citadel does own a stake in Melvin, but it was the one that bought in at fire sale prices after Melvin had already been laid low. The SEC is sitting there in the US, the financial watchdog over there, scratching its head, wondering what to do. And it's been scratching its head even harder after people got locked out from buying the shares yesterday. Should you just allow people to wildly punt on an overvalued stock, or should you step in to seek to protect them? What if you've allowed them to do it for 16 days and you haven't stopped them? What do you do then? It's spread over to the UK. There was talk about there people worried about shorted stocks going up here, so some of the hedge funds were dumping them. The FCA warned yesterday about market abuse and high risk trading. Should the FCA step in? What should you do? Should people be free to make their own stupid mistakes? Or when you hear people YOLOing their life savings, you only live once, as it's called, into a massively overvalued stock. And they're not even buying the shares, they're buying call options. Do you decide that maybe you should take a slightly paternalistic stance and step in? And is it really Wall Street that's going to end up getting screwed over here? Or is it ultimately the little guy?
Helen, do you think, and I mentioned this because I was reading, I think it's Interactive Investor sent a press release asking from Bitcoin to GameStop, basically, is it lockdown boredom to a degree that's causing us to make some of these more short-term harmful decisions that are not in our long-term best financial interest? Do you think there's an element of that at play here? So, I mean, for the smaller investor, for the, well, I wouldn't say you and I's, but you know what I mean. Is there a bit of boredom?
Yeah, I think there absolutely could be. You're right, people have a lot of time on their hands. And in certain cases, you know, people have saved up quite a lot of money during lockdown. And it, you know, investing is something that people would think about. I think the psychology behind GameStop story is fascinating. Something I was thinking about is, you know, who these people are who are buying up these stocks, you know, and I was thinking people around my age. So I'm in my early 30s, and people my age, you know, we were sort of looking for our first jobs around the time of the financial crisis, and, you know, probably do have a bit of an axe to grind with kind of high finance and Wall Street. And, you know, I think there's a case to be made that maybe these are the kind of people who are buying up these stocks thinking, you know, I've had at some points quite a hard time because of, you know, these hedge funds, and why not put a bit of money in and try and kind of claw something back from them? It's really interesting. But I think Simon's right as well. You know, there's definitely a point about awareness if, you know, these are people who are just deciding to play on the stock market a bit because of lockdown boredom. You know, they're, I mean, perhaps the regulator doesn't need to kind of strongly step in, but I think, yeah, definitely there needs to be more, you know, just a kind of bit more warning. And if you look at some of the articles that have been written on this as well, I think there's a responsibility to kind of make it clear that you do stand to really lose quite a bit of money by doing this.
Do you think this might be just be a flash in the pan moment? And you can throw Bitcoin in as well into all of this. Unusual activity in an unusual time, Simon. But actually, do you really need the regulators to get involved? Because, well, it's not going to be a few years anyway till they actually do anything. So, or actually, is there a pattern that's changing here?
Oh, there's a number of patterns that are changing here. The speed at which a speculative bubble can pick up. I mean, this is like we talked about the speed of the Bitcoin rise and the bubbles in Bitcoin, but this is unbelievable. Also, ultimately, because it's not, there is absolutely zero evidence that it is worth any of those blown up, inflated numbers. It's only worth it because people keep buying it. You've got these messages like it's hold the line. It's literally people have discovered that they can make the share price go up at will and try to keep it up. And that's what they've been doing. It's the language of battle and aggression and anger and things like that that's going on. At least with Bitcoin, you've got the true believer thing. You've got the thing where people believe it's the future of finance. Now, that's not everybody who's bought Bitcoin. Lots of people just bought Bitcoin because it was going up and they thought they could make some money. Momentum trading is as old as the hills, where you buy something that's going up. We talked about this on the podcast last week. Again, it's you buy something that's going up. You don't try to get in at the absolute bottom. You don't try to get out at the absolute top. But as long as you get in lower than you get out, and you keep an eye on the momentum and you watch for the momentum changing, then that's what you do. There's a whole school of investing and trading built around it. And that cares a little less about the fundamentals of what you're buying. But at least there's usually a pretense that it's worth something, or there is a reason for the demand. There's a reason why the stock is going up other than people just buying it. This is literally just people making the price of something go up. They've discovered, like ants moving something really big, that if they all work together, they can make the price go up at will. And I think that there is some of this fueled by anger. There is a generation that were royally screwed over by the financial crisis. Not necessarily the homeowner generation at the time, not necessarily some of the older people at the time, but people all over the place were screwed over by it. The banks essentially created a colossal credit bubble, with governments and regulators turning a blind eye, you know, from the FCA to the SEC to our own Gordon Brown, who was making speeches about how proud he was of the innovation in the UK's financial sector, the innovation that was literally slicing and dicing those mortgages to sell on in London. You know, they were US mortgages, but they were sliced and diced in London in many cases. And then the bill was shifted from the banks and their shareholders to sovereign nations. We took on the bill in the UK. Now, ironically, the US did a better job of shifting that bill back onto private enterprise. But there is a lot of anger, and there's anger from people who are 5 to 10 years younger than me. I'm in my early 40s, who came out of university or came out of school at a time when the financial crisis was raging on and the aftermath of it, and you couldn't get a job. You know, you had those stories of, like, you know, 300 people applying for a job in Waterstones and stuff like that. And they've been held back by it. And then all of a sudden, they're just getting to the point where their careers are really kicking off, and you get coronavirus. And people, and they've been locked down, people have been locked down to protect an older generation, largely speaking. They are at less risk personally from it. They're being asked to make a sacrifice, and many people have quite willingly made that sacrifice for their friends, for their family, for people that they don't know. But there is a residual anger there, and that residual anger has been harnessed in what's gone on with GameStop. It's then spilled over into other companies. AMC, a cinema chain, amusingly, anything old tech, BlackBerry, Nokia, hold the line on Nokia. It's just, you know, it's funny. It's an amusing story, right? But the problem is like, underlying this amusing story is a colossal speculative bubble and high risk option trading. And, you know, I have been reading the Reddit, Wall Street Reddit's thread, you know, from as this was unfolding, and I'm reading messages of people saying that, you know, they've convinced their mum to YOLO her life savings into GameStop because this is a once in a lifetime opportunity to make a load of money. I've spoken to people in my job over the years who've lost their life savings, whether it was through a scam or a dodgy investment or taking far more risk than they should have done. And it's not a good scene. Like, they're really upset, and they're like, well, how could I have been so stupid? And it's all very well on the way up saying, like, why are we stopping people from making money and fighting the hedge funds? But that won't be the story on the way down. The story on the way down will be, why didn't somebody stop people doing this? And with every bubble, you know, from tulips to the 1920s to the dot-com era, it's not the institutional investors and Wall Street and the city that loses out. It is the small investor. So, but how do you work out how to protect them? And then the only other thing I'd say is, like, the narrative has become that this is about anger. It's about fighting back. And there's an irony involved in the thing people are fighting back against are the hedge funds. Hedge funds didn't really have that much to do with the financial crisis in terms of creating it. That was more the banks and the investment banks. The hedge funds were actually betting against the investment banks. They were calling them out on the mortgages. Watch The Big Short, you know. But there is this conspicuous wealth. People have got, certain sections of society have grown so much richer and so much more conspicuously richer over the last, you know, 12, 13 years, while other people have suffered. So I get the anger. The anger might be slightly misplaced, but I think we should be really careful with the narrative of anger and fighting back. I think columnists, people like myself, and people far more high profile, should be careful about that anger narrative and feeding that anger narrative, because it helps people convince themselves of that it's all about anger. And there's a big debate going on between, they say, all this is everyone's talking about, big debate going on between me and my friends on our WhatsApp thread about whether this is anger and fighting the system or greed. My argument is that a large part of this is being driven by greed, right? And then this, and then anger. I said I'd go at least 60-40 greed to anger, and probably 80-20. In many cases, people are seeing a chance to make a quick buck and to jump in. God knows how this one ends. I don't know.
I was just about to ask you, Simon, where does this go now? And also GameStop. There's sort of one in the middle kind of going, what are you doing with this now? Are they closing the stores? Are they, you know, is this it for them? They're safe, hurrah. Or is this just like, nah?
That's what my wife asked me. She was like, so, like, do they benefit in any way? I was like, well, apart from the fact their share price is massively overinflated, I mean, they could use the opportunity to raise money through a rights issue, knowing that they could raise more money than they would otherwise be able to at a higher price. But everybody knows that, I mean, the line's not going to hold forever, is it? Come on, like, people are going to sell out. Like, no, we're going to hold the line. We're going to hold the line. That's what people don't realize. We can just keep going up, and we can make it hold. It's like, people are going to break. They're going to start taking profits. We saw it yesterday. Share price came down substantially yesterday as the buying pressure ebbs away because, you know, Robinhood stopped people buying. And a lot of the trading apps in the UK, you couldn't buy in either. Trading 212, you couldn't buy in. Free Trade was delaying orders. So I used my Free Trade. I tested it out. Skin in the game and all that. Yesterday, could I buy some GameStop shares? So I used a relatively small amount of money, but enough that it would be meaningful to have some skin in the game. 200 quid, mm-hmm. basically, in my Free Trade account that was already in there in another share that I put in to try to buy GameStop shares. It said this was in late morning, and it said it would be queued after 3 p.m. So it queued after 3 p.m. and it just said pending, pending, pending. And then it said order rejected. So I was like, right, okay, see if it'll work again. So I tried to see if it would work again. And it did actually go through. So you could buy them, but it was with Free Trade, but it was very, very difficult. Trading 212, I think, had stopped people buying them at one point. Robinhood had stopped people buying them. So now, but what do they do now? Like, once they start letting people buy them again, will people start buying? Will there be this kind of hold the line thing? And just to, you know, follow through on the bit that I was saying, I'm down £60 on that £200. But will people come back in? Will they start buying? Will the buying pressure come back? Will the shares start going back up? Does the regulator try to unpick this, try to take the heat out of the situation? What happens to all the people who've bought in? I mean, has Robinhood acted badly? I mean, because I don't, Robin Hood hasn't done like what the conspiracy theorists are saying, but it has stopped people trading. If it did it to protect consumers, then surely it should have done it and nipped it in the bud ages ago. If it did it for some other reason, because it couldn't fulfill the orders, then it needs to explain itself properly and it needs to be investigated. And if it did it for any underhand reason, then it should lose its license. I think you had the completely bizarre scenario of US left-wing politician Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez stepping in with a tweet saying, we now need to know more about Robinhood app's decision to block retail investors from purchasing stock while hedge funds are freely able to trade the stock as they see fit. As a member of the Financial Services Committee, I'd support a hearing if necessary. This is literally a left-wing politician supporting the right of small investors to punt their savings on a wildly overvalued stock using high-risk financial derivatives from a consumer protection point of view. I mean, that one's a hard one to get your head around. And there's a reason why the hedge funds could still trade the stock. And that's because they have like professional trading relationships with like major brokers because they're hedge funds. There isn't a guy at the hedge fund just sitting there trading on Robinhood. He's not buying and selling out. There's not one guy in the corner with the Robinhood app that they're like, John, can you buy this, mate? you've got this kind of the fallout. It is going to be fascinating. My concern is that there's going to be a lot of people who, unfortunately, in that fascinating fallout, lose an awful lot of money. And I'm a libertarian when it comes to finance at heart. I fully support people's right to make stupid decisions and lose money in stupid ways. But I do think there are some things where you have to become a little bit paternalistic. I think the time for being paternalistic was like 2 weeks ago, not now.
These are crazy times, Simon, crazy times. Let's talk about another favourite lockdown activity, and that is going online, looking at new homes. But with thousands of potentially suitable properties at your fingertips, it can feel like looking for a needle in a haystack, I imagine, at times, if you are actually actively looking to buy and it's not just a bit of dreaming because you don't want to be in your flat anymore. So how can you make sure that you don't scroll past your dream home? Well, this is when you've rounded up some of the more useful online tricks that you can use to help you in your search. So Helen, what is in there?
Yeah, so you're right. Looking at new homes has become the absolute favourite lockdown pastime. The market is so hot at the moment. There's so many things on the market. And I imagine searches on websites like Rightmove and Zoopla are just going absolutely through the roof. So yeah, if you are sort of seriously looking for a new place, and there's a few things you can do, little sort of tech tricks to make sure that, you know, you do get alerted when things that are right for you might be on the market, and you can sort of track different things about properties. One of the things that's quite good to do is to track sort of historic data on a property. So if you've got your eye on something, you know, you want to see, for example, how much that house sold for the last time it was sold a few years ago, or how the price has sort of gone up or down over time. There's a Google Chrome browser extension. You just kind of download it like a little app and it fits into your browser. So if you're searching on Rightmove or Zoopla, this will bring up a little alert. You can see how the value has changed over the last few years. Other stuff, there's some mortgage related things. So a company called Dashly has just brought out another Google extension, which brings up what your monthly mortgage payments would be on a property. So you can be browsing a home and it'll give you an idea. You have to put in some of your sort of financial information and, you know, obviously things like what type of mortgage you're looking for, but it'll bring up an estimate of your monthly mortgage payments, which can be really helpful if you're looking quite seriously. A few other things as well, if you're a first-time buyer, there is a new website called Home Finder, which is essentially sort of a digital mortgage calculator. We obviously have our own on This Is Money, but it goes a little bit further than that. So it also, once you've put in your information, it becomes a sort of little savings planner. So you put in how much you earn and what kind of property value you're targeting. And yeah, it gives a really useful little ticker of how long you've got to save. And then it also brings up a map and shows you the areas that you could probably afford a home in once you've saved up your deposit. So really helpful thing to, you know, if you're at that stage where you're saving but you're not quite there yet, just a way to kind of keep track of what you need to be saving and sort of where you need to be looking, which can be really helpful. Just lots of really useful little tricks that might give you a bit of an upper hand, especially when the property market is so busy.
Marvellous. Go to This Is Money for the full article, but well explained there, Helen. But talking about buying a house seriously and mortgages, the difference in interest rates between a 2 and a 5 year fix at the moment is the smallest it has been since 2013. Now, this is according to new data from comparison site MoneyFacts. In 2020, the average annualised rate gap was just 0.27%. Traditionally, 2 year fixes have been popular with buyers because their rates were much lower, but this is now not the case. So what do you do? Firstly, why is this the case, Assistant Personal Finance Editor Helen Crane? Why is it so close?
I think, you know, there's different theories on this, but I think it's mortgage lenders looking at all of the uncertainty that's going on at the moment in people's finances and essentially thinking that it's probably quite a good idea to have people locked in for 5 years on their products if they can. To keep them, you know, people are probably looking at perhaps switching around quite a lot when things are quite uncertain. And if you can get someone locked in on a 5 year fixed mortgage with you, you know, you've got them for at least 5 years. It's quite a competitive market for mortgages at the moment. You know, rates going up and down a lot. And I think lenders just want you to be kind of signed up with them for as long as possible, really. Mm-hmm.
Simon, does that then make a 5 year fix an absolute no brainer?
I think it's not quite an absolute no brainer. But for many people, it's quite close to one. I think that unless you realistically think that you're going to be moving in about 2 years' time or selling up or there's another reason, if you think you're going to be in your property for 5 years, and bear in mind that 2 years goes very quickly and most people spend longer living in their property than they think they will. So if you're buying it, you probably are going to end up being there for 5 years. That's what the statistics show. That it is worth considering. If you do move, most of them are portable and you can take them with you, but you will need to be reassessed on the new property and the lender might not agree to it and so on. And you might not find that extra borrowing is as competitive as it can be. So there are some caveats with that, but most people won't move. Most people will be in the same place. Probably for most people, the sensible course of action is to take a 5 year fix, because then they can file that one away under stuff that I've sorted out, stuff that I don't need to worry about, monthly payments that I know exactly how much they're going to be. and they can just keep paying the monthly payments, paying off the mortgage, and not worry about it for another 5 years when they'll have to get a new mortgage and they'll probably have to pay some more fees. So having taking repeated 2 year fixes involves more fees as well. And the rates are now so close that you're not really saving that much money on a 2 year fix. With a 5 year fix, it's actually easier to pass some of the affordability checks. So you might find it easier to get the mortgage as well. And so I do think it is relatively close to a no-brainer. But I've been saying that for a long time. But genuinely, I think the rates on five-year fixes, they probably can't get much cheaper. We've been saying that for a long time, and they have got much cheaper. But I struggle to see how they could get much cheaper than where they are now. And realistically, from a historic perspective, they're just really cheap anyway. If you fixed in January to December 2016, you'd have paid 3.13% on average. If you did it now, you'd pay 2.69% on average. Now, you might kick yourself and think, oh, I could have saved the difference between 3.13% and 2.69%. Actually, that's hardly anything. Like, realistically, that's just super cheap money. And it doesn't make that big a difference. You know, it's not the difference between 5 and 2. 5% and 2%, that is a big difference. So, yeah, I think it's get some mortgage advice, speak to a decent broker, get the whole of the market compared, think about what it means for you and how it fits you. But if somebody says to you, you should take a 2 year fix instead of a 5 year fix, and there's no particular reason in your mind, question them as to why they're telling you that.
I keep thinking about what Lee Boyce of this parish said about 2 year fixes. He said, you know, blink and you're already there after 2 years. You'll be shocked at how quickly it goes by. But there are things to think about. And Helen, look, we are living in uncertain times. You know, jobs are predicted to go in greater numbers as we move forward. What should you be thinking about additionally? What is different in this scenario or in this situation that perhaps our advice would be different than in the past?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if you're really uncertain about your job and you don't have savings behind you to meet your mortgage payments, if you were to lose your job, don't take out a mortgage. But then on the other hand, you know, if you are perhaps a bit uncertain, but you know, you're confident that if you still did lose your job, you would still be able to make your payments, it might actually be a good idea to take on a five-year fixed mortgage. For example, you know, also if you were considering becoming self-employed, because you don't actually need to tell your mortgage lender if your employment circumstances change, as long as you can still make the payments. So, you know, for example, if you were tied in for 5 years, you wouldn't need to worry about, being sort of reassessed after 2 years and then your circumstances have changed and you find it more difficult to get a mortgage. So if you do have a bit of money behind you, but you might be sort of changing employment circumstances, it might be worth actually kind of tying yourself in. I think another point, people who might be a bit more cautious about the advice to take a 5 year six is perhaps first time buyers. The rates on sort of lower LTV mortgages, so sort of 10% deposits, they have been a bit volatile. They've gone up quite a lot since the pandemic by about 1%. So again, like Simon said, it's not sort of huge amounts of money, but you know, there's an argument that it might be worth taking a 2 year deal with a view to then getting a lower rate in a couple of years' time. But it's not sort of huge amounts of money that you're talking about.
Excellent, Helen. Thank you very much. Now, Grace has been on the case in This Is Money's new Consumer Champion column. And this week, it's a rather sad one, actually. I mean, Grace received an email from a reader, and this is what the reader said. My husband bought a new Skoda Octavia in September 2019, but sadly passed away unexpectedly early last year. Following his death, I kept trying to speak to someone at VW Financial Services about the car loan agreement, but either couldn't get through due to lines being busy or was told I wasn't a priority as I could meet the monthly payments. After eventually getting through, I was told to pay around £7,500, £8,000 as the full and final settlement figure, which meant I would then have ownership of the car. I did this and believed it to be the end of the matter. However, a few weeks later, I was told that was actually a voluntary termination figure and I still owed them a further £13,500 to clear the finance. This has been a nightmare and caused me much stress and anxiety. What can I do? Simon, this is This is horrible. At a time which is incredibly stressful, she's going through a bereavement. She has to now deal with this issue with the car. But just explain briefly what this means to people who don't really understand about kind of car financing and termination figures and all those sorts of things. What are the practicals around this before we get to the specific case?
The practicals are that the car was bought on a PCP deal, which is personal contract purchase. A lot of people, the vast majority of new car buyers, use finance, and the vast majority of those use PCP deals. And this is where what you're effectively doing is paying the depreciation in the car over a set period of time. So say you sign up for 36 months, you might put down a deposit, or you might put down no deposit, but there will be an amount by which that car is forecast to depreciate over those 3 years. And you will have that divided up, plus the interest that's added. In some cases, it's 0% interest. In some cases, it's small interest. And divided up into monthly payments. And you meet those monthly payments. Then at the end of the 3 years, you have a couple of choices. You can either make the final balloon payment, as it's known, which is the agreed at the start of the deal and is how much it would cost you to take full ownership of the car, because it's really important to remember with a PCP deal that you don't technically own the car while you're in the PCP deal. The car company, the finance company, owns the car. And you have to meet certain conditions, only do certain mileage, keep it maintained, don't fill it full of dents and smashes and things like that. Otherwise, you'll pay through the nose when you hand it back. So you make the balloon payment, and you keep the car. Or what a lot of people do is they just hand back the car and then they put the deposit down on another car and they repeat the cycle again. And many of the car companies have large financial services arms that deal with this because they sell directly through their dealers. Skoda is part of the Volkswagen group. So the lady in this instance was dealing with Volkswagen Financial Services. And she was given the proper runaround on this. Many people don't quite get their head around PCP deals anyway. Quite a lot of people who take PCP deals don't get their head around PCP deals. But if you've not taken one yourself, a lot of people just don't have that much interest, so they don't get around it. So she was trying to find out what she owed, what would have to be paid. And she was given this final settlement figure, except it then turned out that wasn't actually the final settlement figure. She was asked for another £13,500. And then, as you said, you know, when you were reading out the question, she was given the runaround. What compounded the issue here is that without sorting out the car arrangement, because it's a financial arrangement, she couldn't complete probate, which is what you have to do to access someone's money and sort out everything when they die. Without sorting probate, she couldn't sell her house, which was a shared asset in the will, and she was paying more on the mortgage than she wanted to, and she wanted to sell the house. And essentially, this whole thing went round and round in circles. She was even informed that a finance marker had gone on her name. Grace stepped in with Grace on the case, and as is sometimes the way, things started to suddenly get sorted out. And Volkswagen Financial Services ended up apologising and agreeing to the final settlement figure that she was originally given being the final settlement figure. Graham Hill, car finance expert who we spoke to, he's got over 35 years experience and is not the famous racing driver, reviewed the case and said that an enormous error had been made. He said the figure that is the voluntary termination figure that would require the car to be handed back to Volkswagen Financial Services has been mistakenly passed on as a full and final settlement. It was Volkswagen Financial Services who decided to pass over the handling of the settlement request to Phillips and Cohen, which is a company, who were therefore acting on behalf of Volkswagen Financial Services. The letter to you is quite clear. The payment of £7,743.32 is the full and final amount. Clearly, there's been a breakdown in communications between Volkswagen Financial Services and Phillips Cohen, but that is irrelevant. A figure was given as a full and final settlement. It was paid, and the car is now owned by the estate. In my opinion, there is no argument. Volkswagen Financial Services apologised, agreed that the outstanding finance was wiped altogether, and said that the lady could keep the car. And a spokesperson said, following our previous comment, our specialist team has now reviewed the case and we are able to support a solution that enables the customer to remain in her vehicle. We sincerely apologise for any stress or inconvenience we may have added at this difficult time. What would have happened if Volkswagen hadn't changed its mind about the outcome? Lady could have gone to the Financial Ombudsman Service And also could have sought help from her insurer if she had legal cover and needed to have a legal battle, and also could have spoken to Citizens Advice. Anybody in this kind of situation who's got any questions about this kind of thing, you know, ask the question, get on to the finance company, and if you don't get any joy, you can email through to us and ask for help from Grace on the case. Email in to grace.gausden, G-R-A-C-E, .gausden at thisismoney.co.uk, and please put Grace in the case in the subject line so she knows.
Marvellous, thank you very much. Now, we may not be travelling very far at the moment, but hopeful shoppers, hopeful travellers still wanting to rack up the air miles have a new option following last week's tie-up between British Airways and Nectar. But is it worth it? Helen, what's the deal?
So American Express has brought out a new credit card, which is a tie-up with Nectar. Basically, you can get 1.25 Avios points for every pound you spend, which is pretty generous when it comes to sort of flight points on a credit card. It's actually better than the British Airways American Express card and also the American Express Gold card when it comes to points. They also have higher fees after the first year, over £100, whereas the Nectar card only has £25 after the first year. So it's a fairly good deal. Not that anyone is kind of going anywhere anytime soon, but you do sort of wonder, when we are allowed to fly, how many people will be paying for flights with actual money rather than points or vouchers? And
it does make me wonder as well, with the airline industry in the sort of straits it's in at the moment, how generous these points schemes are going to be. I mean, Simon, your views just briefly on the kind of credit card with bonuses market?
Well, I think there's two industries that are suffering slightly at the moment, intertwined here. There's the airline industry, for obvious reasons. Nobody's flying, and the credit card industry isn't doing that well either. People aren't spending as much money on their credit cards. I mean, have you seen the Barclaycard adverts at the moment? I think they're for Barclaycard. I hope they're not for Barclaycard, because then I won't just be repeating an advert. But it's got Nick Frost in, and it's about Section 75. They're telling people about how spending on your credit card can give you extra consumer rights because your credit card company backs you up. I mean, to me, that says the credit card companies are really desperate for people to do some more spending on their credit cards, because they're telling people about something that is really helpful for them, backs them up, and costs the credit card companies money. Maybe they're just being altruistic and it's financial education, I don't know. But yes, it's very interesting. I've certainly never seen that being the line in an advert before. So I think, yeah, you're going to find these things getting more generous. The problem is, are you going to be able to spend them at the end of it? And what are you going to get at the end of it? In theory, you can spend them. But people sometimes say it is harder to book flights with Avios than it is to book them with real money. You might find there aren't that many flights when the flights start to come back. I suppose you could always use them to buy a sandwich, although beware the cost of a sandwich and Avios points. It might be one of the most expensive lunches that you ever eat. And do watch out, because this card comes with an APR of 27.3%. An interest rate of 22.2% on purchases, and after the first year, a fee of £25, which Rob Burgess, editor of frequent flyer website Head for Points and friend of This Is Money, said makes the card much harder to justify after year one.
All right, then, we'll leave it there. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast and join in the debate in reader comments.
Marvellous. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.